Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to start today with a few short-form articles, the first of which is on Palantir. Palantir's stock is on the way back up, despite investors' broad skepticism about AI. The company share surged 29% Tuesday after it surpassed estimates in its latest earnings report, boosting CEO Alex Karp's net worth to $15.3 billion. The company disclosed a 93% year-over-year boost in overall revenue, and analysts from Citi wrote that the company's results further weakened the bear chase case around rising AI competition. Shares of Palantir are now only slightly down this year overall by less than 2%. Erasing most of a month's-long decline. And that article and the next one are from Forbes Daily Dozen, dated August 3rd. Here's the second article. Billionaires are up in arms over New York City's new tax on second homes, but it won't make much of a dent in their fortunes. Forbes looked at the impact of the pied-à-terre tax, which targets homes that aren't primary residences, on 10 billionaires. Hedge fund billionaire Ken Griffin, who has sparred with Mayor Zoran Mondani over the tax, would have to pay an estimated $12.9 million through 2031. That's the equivalent of a person worth $100,000 paying $25 in extra taxes. It's almost like Mondani's not even really taxing the rich like he promised, said Nathan Goldman, a professor of accounting at North Carolina State University, who has written about the tax for Forbes. Now for a couple of quick headlines, also from the Forbes Daily Dozen. Amazon's better-than-expected earnings report propelled its stock to its largest gain in a decade, boosting Jeff Bezos' fortune as he once again became the world's third richest person. Bitcoin plunged to its lowest level in weeks on Friday as Strategy, the world's largest institutional holder of the cryptocurrency, said it would sell up to $5 billion of Bitcoin. And the current price of Bitcoin as of August 5th, $63,792 per Bitcoin. And now here's a quick article, again from Forbes Daily Dozen. Silicon Valley's other China problem. It's training their AI. The U.S. has spent years trying to keep advanced AI chips out of China. It paid far less attention to another scarce input in the AI race. The expert-made data sets that teach models how to reason through spreadsheets, code, science, and white-collar work. Silicon Valley startups like Mercore and Surge AI that sell high-quality training data sets to OpenAI, Anthropic, and the U.S. government are also selling them to China's leading AI labs, according to documents and communications reviewed by Forbes. It is packaged human expertise produced by specialist networks and shaped by task designs, grading rubrics, and quality controls. The expensive machinery that teaches models to handle difficult professional tasks. While the U.S. has long prohibited China from buying the chips that power America's top-tier AI models, it's largely overlooked the expertise data required to train them. The business is worth hundreds of millions of dollars annually, and it's helping Chinese AI models close the gap with their American rivals. After the compute needed to train the models, good quality data is the next most important thing, Nathan Lambert, a former research scientist at the Allen Institute for AI, told Forbes. As the U.S. and China vie for AI dominance, some of the same Silicon Valley startups supplying OpenAI, Anthropic, and the federal government are quietly training Beijing's top labs, effectively arming both sides of the AI race. Now we're going to a slightly longer form article, this one on the EV market. It's by Adam Omsman, it's from Fortune magazine, dated August 5th. Americans can't buy Chinese EVs. Waymo is importing thousands. Chinese automakers are now the de facto global standard for electric vehicles. BYD is outselling Tesla with highly affordable models. Consumer electronics giant Xiaomi is rolling out stylish sedans and SUVs outfitted with dizzying in-cabin infotainment tech. But staggeringly high tariffs, hovering at around 127.5% for Chinese-built EVs, have kept those cars largely out of American driveways. But they have not kept them out of Waymo's fast-growing U.S. robotaxi fleet. In late May, Alphabet's self-driving vehicle company began deploying small electric vans built by China's Zeekr brand, which it calls the Waymo Ojai, in cities including Los Angeles and San Francisco. At the time, Waymo could only say it had more than 100 of the friendly-faced, periwinkle-colored minivans on the road. Most industry watchers assumed the Mountain View, California-based company would ultimately operate fewer than 1,000 owing to the excessive import fees. That's not the case. Since 2024, Zeekr has shipped more than 3,200 units of its CM1E, its Chinese market name, through the port of Los Angeles, including over 2,600 so far this year, based on bills of lading data compiled by research firm Import Genius. While Waymo isn't identified as the recipient, Zeekr doesn't have any other U.S. partner. If they were imported at the CM1E's Chinese market price of $39,000, tariffs would drive the cost up to nearly $89,000, excluding the amount of Waymo's autonomous driving hardware that likely exceeds $10,000. The market assumes Waymo's future with the Ojai is a dead end due to tariffs on Chinese imports. So did we. That 3,200 units is the at least figure based on documents sourced directly from U.S. Customs that identify either Zeekr or the model of the vehicle, William George, director of research for Import Genius, told Forbes. The declared value of the vehicles isn't included, however. The market assumes Waymo's future with Ojai is a dead end due to tariffs on Chinese auto imports. Michael Morton, a research analyst with Moffitt Nathanson, said in a recent investment report, "To be frank, we were surprised by what we found." His firm estimates that Waymo imports an average of 300 Zeekrs per month. Also, using data from Import Genius, that level is materially higher than what investors assumed, he said. Waymo declined to confirm the import tally and how much it's paying for the vehicles. At this stage, we're serving early access riders across San Francisco, L.A., and Phoenix with over 300 Ojais, said company spokesman Chris Bonelli. We're already in 11 cities with ambitious plans to serve dozens more, and the Ojai will be a big part of our scaling efforts. Certainly the company, which has raised far more than $20 billion, since it began as Google self-driving car project in 2009, can afford the inflated price of the Ojai, although it complicates the company's push to lower costs to help achieve profitability. The industry's leading robo-taxi company already operates its commercial service in 11 U.S. cities and is prepared to launch in 4 more. It's also taking the service abroad, with testing in Tokyo and London. Waymo announced plans to add electric vehicles from Zeekr, a unit of China's Geely Auto, in late 2021, noting that the model was styled in Sweden with Geely-backed Volvo cars. But that was before 100% tariff on Chinese EVs took effect, on top of a standard 2.5% duty on all imported autos, and a 25% fee for certain strategic products, including autos, auto parts, aluminum, and steel. Add 3,200 or more Zeekr models would dramatically expand Waymo's fleet, which totaled about 3,900 units as of last month, including test vehicles, comprised mainly of electric Jaguar One Pace SUVs. That product, however, has been discontinued. Along with Zeekr's, Waymo is also preparing to add modified versions of Hyundai Motor's IONIQ 5 electric hatchback, built at the automaker's Georgia plant. Waymo currently books more than 500,000 paid rides a week and is targeting 1 million per week by year-end. If it hits that level, annual revenue in 2027 would top $1 billion based on an estimated average fare of $20 per ride. That's far beyond what any U.S. competitor is likely to generate. But to do that, it needs a lot more vehicles. Given that it's a high-profile partnership for Zeekr, an EV brand owned by China's Geely Auto, and the excess production capacity of that country's automakers, Waymo is probably paying far less than the $39,000 charged in China for a CM1E, said Tu Li, managing director of consultancy Sino Auto Insights. My guess is they're getting it super cheap from Zeekr at a big discount, Li said. Also, Geely could be eating some of that tariff since Waymo's kind of stuck. Their AV stack was designed specifically for Ojai prior to all these tariffs and connected vehicle restrictions. The Waymo model will soon get electric van competition from Amazon's Zoox, which just received federal permission to operate its purpose-built robo-taxis that don't have steering wheels, pedals, or mirrors on public roads. Zoox builds the 4-passenger vehicles with sliding train-style doors at a small Silicon Valley factory. They'll soon begin ferrying paying customers in Las Vegas, with San Francisco, Los Angeles, and other cities to follow. While the current number of Ojais on U.S. roads probably isn't high at the moment, the minivan is already becoming a key platform for both Waymo and Alphabet. Its sliding doors on each side of the vehicle and flat floor make it easy to enter and exit than the Jaguars, and it has a roomier passenger cabin. It's also using what Waymo calls its 6th-generation hardware set, with improved vision and computing power at 50% less cost than the 5th-generation system used in the I-Pace. Waymo has not, however, confirmed the cost of the new system. Last week, the company said it's integrating Google's Gemini AI chatbot into the Ojai fleet, activated with the touch of a button in new rear seat screens. It also allows riders to use voice commands to control cabin temperature, get information about neighborhoods they're passing through, or even ask the vehicle to pull over. Tariffs aren't the only barrier to ensure compliance with U.S. security laws aimed at Chinese companies. Zeekr units have to come in without any sensors or computing systems, which Waymo installs at its factory in Mesa, Arizona. To be permitted for use on U.S. roads, Waymo also has to ensure that the Zeekrs have been crash-tested and meet federal safety standards. We prioritize partners who share our obsession with safety, she said. Every vehicle in our fleet is chosen for its high safety rating and structural integrity. Given that the partnership was formed about 6 years ago, it's likely Waymo didn't want to scrap the deal, even with the tariffs, because it's been tailoring its system for the Ojai, said analyst Lee. They may have done a calculation and said, for us to redesign the entire hardware stack for a similar vehicle that offers the flexibility that Ojai does and the space, it might end up costing it something like $100,000 per vehicle if we switch to an electric van like the Volkswagen ID, he said, that is a heavy lift. As many of you may already know, one of our main problems in tariff negotiations with China was that China has a virtual monopoly on rare earth production. Here's an article on that from the Associated Press and Fortune magazine, dated August 4th. America's $500 million bet on rare earths depends on a tiny New Hampshire refinery scaling from 200 kilograms to 120 tons in 2 years. A giant American flag hanging on the wall of a warehouse in New Hampshire hints at the national importance of the elements bound inside the mining waste stored in one-ton bags. The company uses electrolysis to separate the key critical elements President Donald Trump's administration desperately wants to produce domestically from the powder left behind at traditional mines. The small Phoenix Tailings Refinery, tucked inside an office park in Exeter, New Hampshire, could play a key role in helping America break the chokehold that China has on the processing of critical minerals, but it will take 14 to 18 months to build a new factory with a $500 million loan from the Pentagon to drastically expand the company's separation and metallization capacity, a particularly weak stage in U.S. mines-to-magnets supply chain. The task that workers carry out in heat-resistant suits and sealed face masks has become more urgent with the war in the Middle East rapidly drawing down munitions, because critical minerals are a key ingredient in widely used U.S. weapons systems such as Tomahawk cruise missiles, THAAD interceptors, and F-35 fighter jets. While the White House is demanding military contractors speed up weapons production, it's also imposing even stricter rules, banning them from sourcing the critical mineral components from China. It'll be a tall order and a challenge to replenish those stocks and scale up in the time frame needed to meet defense demand and regulations, said Anthony Baladon, the chief commercial officer and a co-founder. He said the company is working hard to greatly increase its capacity. Although the U.S. is quickening its pace to rebuild the domestic supply chain of critical minerals, free of control from its most formidable rival, most new U.S. mines are years away from reality. So extracting some of these hard-to-pronounce elements from existing mine waste can help satisfy the growing demand in the meantime. As its name indicates, Phoenix Tailings taps tailings, or waste from traditional mining, as well as recycled magnets and disk drives, as the raw materials for separation and metallization, the stage at which China has the strongest hold. To make inroads, the company, based in Woburn, Massachusetts, plans to build a facility to extract and produce critical metals such as neodymium, praseodymium, terbium, dysprosium, samarium, and yttrium, which are needed in defense, aerospace, and automotive industries. We call it the Freedom Facilities because, ultimately, the purpose of this is to ensure that the entire Western Hemisphere, the United States, and its allies are free of Chinese influence within the rare earth space, Baladon said. On a recent afternoon, two technicians in heat-resistant hazmat suits were operating an apparatus of cylinders, tubes, funnels, and control panels set up on a platform with bright yellow railings. A chemical process involving electricity removes oxygen and turns the oxide's feed into a grayish metal, neodymium praseodymium, which can be used to make extremely strong permanent magnets used in fighter jets, missiles, radar systems, and drones. The metals Phoenix Tailing refines and other critical minerals play an outsized role in defense system, Baladon said. A $150 million weapons system won't work if it's missing critical minerals that may be worth only $20,000 to $30,000, he said. Phoenix Tailings is among the few companies capable of producing the final metal, according to Baladon, but its capacity is only about 200 kilograms, 440 pounds, a year. He said the company will need to scale up to about 5 tons in the next 3 months, but it will be the next year or 2028 before it reaches its goal of 120-ton capacity. For years, the U.S. magnet maker Arnold Magnetic Technologies relied on China for samarium to produce the extremely strong, stable, and high-temperature magnet that goes into precision-guided missiles, such as the Tomahawk. That doesn't work anymore. For Arnold, the solution has come from a relic of Europe's past rare earth industry, abandoned mine dirt in the French city of La Rochelle. Solvay, a Belgium-headquartered chemical company, ceased operations to separate and process rare earth from the mine dirt in the 2000s. That was when China was building up most of the world's processing capacities with a determination to dominate. Then came April 2025, when China weaponized its near monopoly by choking the outflow of processed critical materials and forcing the U.S. government to back off their trade war. It was then that Solvay restarted separating neodymium and praseodymium at the La Rochelle site, and this year it began to separate heavy rare earths such as samarium, dysprosium, and terbium, a Solvay spokesperson said. This ramp-up is driven by several factors: rapidly growing demand for permanent magnets, increased geopolitical focus on supply chain security, and strong customer demand in Europe and the United States for more diversified, resilient, and traceable sources of supply, the company spokesperson said. In Rochester, New York, where Arnold is headquartered, higher costs by Solvay as compared with China have not been a deal-breaker because the samarium cobalt magnets that it manufactures account for only a small cost in a weapon system, said Matt Blake, chief executive officer of Arnold Magnetic Technologies. They are not the absolute cost drivers, he said. Brody Sutherland, chief executive officer of Patriot Critical Minerals Corp., which seeks to explore and mine tungsten in the U.S., is concerned that the U.S. will not be able to get by without China-sourced tungsten after January 1, 2027, a deadline imposed by the Pentagon. The U.S. is fully dependent on imports, with China controlling roughly 80% of the global mine supply and an even larger share of downstream processing, Sutherland said. Efforts to ramp up U.S. production will take years, he said, and in the meantime, the Pentagon and its defense contractors will need to rely on existing inventories, expanded recycling, and limited non-China sources. The need to increase production has become more urgent as the war with Iran digs into the U.S. military's already diminished stockpiles of advanced missile interceptors. This could force the U.S. and its Middle Eastern allies to take more risks to conserve those air defenses, potentially putting American troops at risk, according to an analysis from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington think tank. It's also raised concerns that the U.S. military would have diminished firepower in any potential future conflict with China. CSIS warned in May that it could take at least 3 years to replenish stockpiles of the Tomahawks, Patriots, and THAADs, or Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Interceptors. But just last month, Trump, a Republican, complicated the mission by announcing stricter controls on defense contractor sourcing critical materials from China. His executive order also curtails the Pentagon's waiver authority should a contractor cite non-availability of a domestic source. It criticizes defense contractors for failing to prioritize domestic production. It is the policy of the United States that not only the finished equipment deployed by our military, but also the critical materials and components necessary to manufacture, maintain, sustain, and repair that equipment are sourced domestically or from allied nations, the July 20 order declared. In a statement, Lockheed Martin said, "We continually assess the global rare earth supply chain to ensure access to critical materials that support our customers' missions." Several other major U.S. defense contractors, including Raytheon Technologies and Northrop Grumman, didn't respond to the Associated Press's request for comment. Many of you may be suffering from Elon Musk fatigue, and if you are, just go get a cup of coffee. Here's an article on SpaceX's first revenue call since its IPO. It's by Amanda Giroux. It's from Fortune magazine and is dated August 4th. SpaceX revenue surges 92% to $7.8 billion, blowing past Wall Street's expectations by nearly a billion. SpaceX grew revenue 92% to $7.8 billion in the second quarter, powering past Wall Street's consensus estimate of approximately $6.9 billion in the rocket and connectivity giant's first earnings report as a public company since its June debut on NASDAQ. The company reported a net loss of $541 million, or 9 cents a share, a marked improvement from a $1 billion loss a year ago, and higher than the range of analyst estimates, which spanned from a loss of $1.26 per share to a gain of 33 cents. Adjusted EBITDA nearly tripled to $3.5 billion. Despite the strong results, shares of SpaceX declined in after-hour trading on Tuesday, falling more than 7% following the release of the results. The results land at a pivotal moment for SpaceX, which has tumbled roughly 50% from its peak stock price of $211 days after its IPO on June 12th. Investor anxiety around capital expenditures and sluggish return on massive spending had weighed down tech stocks in recent weeks before markets staged a rally on Tuesday. One major question for investors during the call related to SpaceX's capital spending, which hit $18.4 billion in quarter two alone, with $15.8 billion from the AI segment. The quarterly run rate, $73.5 billion annualized, will outpace the $48.7 billion CapEx consensus analysts had going into this quarter. Thus far, investors have had low patience for higher spending without significant revenue growth and acceleration, in addition to flattering free cash flow figures, which showed in SpaceX's tumbling after-hours trading. SpaceX's second quarter results are fueling a strengthened AI trade with an early $1 billion top-line beat, Starlink's subscriber base doubling year over year, and a flush of new cloud computing contracts that catapulted the AI segment from a loss into positive adjusted EBITDA territory for the first time. More immediately, the release of quarterly numbers will trigger the opening of a lockup provision that will allow pre-IPO shareholders to begin selling a portion of their holdings that could exert some more downward pressure on the stock. An even larger glug of insider selling will become possible after third quarter results later this year, when roughly 900 million additional shares come unlocked, a block larger than the entire IPO issuance. SpaceX's stock price is down more than 5%, in after-hours trading. SpaceX currently has a $100 billion cash cushion. Plus, it raised $25 billion in a bond offering to give it room to run. But investors are likely to have questions about how long it will take for that spending to translate into revenues. Starlink spun up $4.29 billion in quarterly revenue, up 66% year over year, firmly in position as the golden goose of SpaceX. Its operating margin was 38.6%, well above the 35.9% margin analysts had expected. The second quarter wrapped with $12 million Starlink subscribers, double the number a year ago, and up 1.7 million from quarter one. Average revenue per user held steady at $66 a month. Enterprise and government revenue, a booming line item within the business unit, grew 108% year over year to $1.8 billion, boasting partnerships with American Airlines, Southwest, and Virgin Atlantic, and more than $6 billion in contracts with the U.S. Space Force. AI revenue grew 247% year over year to $2.6 billion, fueled by $14.1 billion in new cloud services agreements. Compute capacity grew to 1.4 gigawatts, up from 0.4 gigawatts a year ago, but AI still posted a $1.26 billion operating loss. In the first quarter, the loss was $2.47 billion. During the call, founder and CEO Elon Musk disclosed that the company's internal revenue projections had been revised upward since the June IPO. Our internal projections for reaching $1 trillion in revenue, not annualized revenue run rate, but revenue, have moved up from 2031 to 2030, said Musk, adding that there's a non-zero chance of that being in 2029. Chief Financial Officer Brett Johnston said the $100 billion ARR target for December was now within reach due to cloud contracts and SpaceX's pending Cursor acquisition. However, SpaceX would need to multiply by a factor of 10 in 3 to 4 years to reach $1 trillion, a Herculean feat given that bullish analysts have projected less than half that for 2030. Still, Musk said he believes the incremental revenue gap of $981 billion will close because of SpaceX's next-generation V3 satellite, which he described as an order of magnitude more capable than the current Vision. Even if our monetization per bit dropped by a factor of 10, that would still mean a 10 times increase in the revenue of Starlink, said Musk. It's not out of the question that at some point, Starlink will deliver a majority of the world's internet. Musk also pointed to AI growth, noting that SpaceX is exclusive to NVIDIA for its compute build-out because Musk believes NVIDIA's Vera Rubin architecture is superior. He said SpaceX expects to start launching an orbital AI satellite next year that will allow it to put AI data centers in orbit, lowering costs well below competitors. Now, as one more quick excerpt from another article about Musk, we're going to talk about one of his projections, and this one, I must admit, is out there. This is from an article entitled Elon Musk Delivers Totally Nuts Plans for Moon Robots and Insists a $1 trillion revenue target will be hit. But capital expenditure tanks SpaceX on debut earnings. Now here's the quote from later in the article. Ever the hype man, Musk suggested thinking of SpaceX's satellites as robots, given that they're autonomous and don't need servicing. In the not-so-distant future, Musk mused, robots will be used to scale manufacturing on the moon. From there, moon-based robots will enable SpaceX to build a mass accelerator with solar production. Even Musk admitted it all sounded totally nuts. but it claimed that it could lead the company to scale to 1,000 times the economy of Earth. From there, factories will be built and robots will be helpful with that, Musk added. It sounds like super science fiction right now, but it's going to happen, he said. And whether you believe that or not, it is an interesting prediction. Now we're going to talk Kevin Warsh. And here's an article from Eleanor Pringle from Fortune magazine dated August 4th. Kevin Warsh told Wall Street he'd be sharing less. Goldman Sachs fears a void of Fed facts will only amplify misinformation and instability. Federal Chairman Kevin Warsh has been clear. The central bank has gotten too comfortable sharing its expectations for the path of monetary policy and believes its policy decisions have been hamstrung as a result. Wall Street is now blasting its results. Dialing back communications will be tolerated. A perceived void of information will not be. The boomerang Fed policymaker Warsh served on the Board of Governors from 2006 to 2011 under his mentor, Chairman Ben Bernanke, has been consistent in his criticism of forward guidance, the practice of publicly sharing expectations of where short-term interest rates will go. During a press conference following the meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee last week, Warsh built on his thinking. In reducing forward guidance, he said, market prices can respond to economic data in the direction and the magnitude that they see fit. This ultimately benefits the Fed, he suggested. The central bank need not always and everywhere be the center of attention. For our part, we need to observe market reaction to developments direct and unfiltered. If reaction is welcome, markets delivered. Long-dated bonds spiked after Warsh's statement and remained elevated, while two-year treasuries slumped, reflecting expectations that the Fed would not be tightening financial conditions. The response from investors wasn't necessarily in reaction to what Warsh did or didn't say, J.P. Morgan's Alex Wolf told Fortune. It was a reflection of newfound uncertainty. Increasing noise in the absence of facts is precisely what Goldman Sachs chief U.S. economist Jan Hatzius is worried about. In a note yesterday, Hatzius highlighted that markets over and underreacting to data points may confound the very response that the Fed is watching closely. Participants in short-term interest rate markets, where the Fed matters most, price what they think the Fed will do, not what it should do, Hatzius reasoned. This will remain true if the Federal Open Market Committee provides less information about its thinking, except that markets then have less information and potentially more inaccurate beliefs on what to base their thinking. Such a shift will not provide policymakers with a more reliable source of information about the real economy. Not only does Hatzius believe the new strategy will not achieve its aims, he said it might have two undesirable effects. The first is that if markets don't know which data the Fed deems important, it may not react to updates the Fed later uses as a basis for policy change. As a result, policy will lag the real economy and end up destabilizing rather than stabilizing. Secondly, markets may overreact to a piece of data or a policymaker tidbit, pricing in hikes or cuts that the central bank then fails to deliver. This implies unnecessary volatility in both financial conditions and the impulse from financial conditions to the real economy, Hatzius adds. Warsh is also garnering criticism for seemingly suggesting that familiar yardsticks are moving. Responding to a question about what measure the FOMC uses when discussing the 2% inflation target, the proper standard answer is PCE, the chairman confirmed, referring to the Personal Consumption Expenditure Price Index, which reports changes in the price of goods and services purchased by consumers in the United States. Who knows, come after next January, what we might say about strategy, Warsh continued. There were hints that a shift may be coming. After all, one of Warsh's Fed task force is charged with revisiting how the Federal Reserve understands and responds to the drivers of inflation. But the outcome of this doesn't explain the blanks being raised at present, argued Jeremy Siegel, emeritus professor of finance at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, writing for WisdomTree, where he serves as a senior economist. Siegel said the argument to reduce forward guidance is a legitimate one. However, even without providing explicit forward guidance, central bankers still have an obligation to explain the economic framework behind their decisions. This press conference fell well short. And while Warsh may be only one voice at the table, he is the voice, added Hatzius. In the absence of his outlook, markets may erroneously rely on insight that doesn't reflect the view of the entire committee. If Warsh doesn't distill the individual views of participants into a coherent message, or doesn't communicate this message to the public, the loudest voices and most frequent speakers on the committee will likely have the biggest impact, whether or not they are representative of the medium FOMC voter. For those of you NFL fans, here's an article on the NFL's attempts to establish a foothold in Europe and around the world from Fortune magazine, dated August 4th by Sam Birchall. We're not going to do the entire article because it's quite long, but we will do some major excerpts. The NFL's previous push into Europe lost $400 million. Why is it trying again? When the Pittsburgh Steelers and the New Orleans Saints walk onto the turf of the Stade de France on October 25th, the National Football League will stage its first competitive game on French soil. It's part of a record 9-game international run this season, spanning 4 continents and 7 countries, including London, Madrid, Melbourne, and Rio de Janeiro. The series is part of the NFL's strategy to deepen its foothold in Europe. We're using the game as a catalyst, Tim Ellis, the league's chief marketing officer, tells Fortune, to get people interested, to get them talking, to get the media to pay attention. For Ellis, the 80,000 tickets available for the Stade de France game matter far less than the millions of fans the league hopes to convert in the weeks and months after the final whistle. There are signs that the league is generating real demand overseas. London will have hosted 45 games by the end of this season and remains the league's most mature overseas market. Melbourne and Paris, where Ellis says the league's fan base has grown past 14 million, are also expected to draw big crowds. Ticket interest for the NFL's Melbourne match has surpassed the Melbourne Cricket Ground's 100,000-seat capacity, with more than 151,000 fans registering interest. Meanwhile, more than 600,000 people joined the virtual queue for last year's Steelers game at Croke Park in Dublin. Ticket and hospitality revenue, Ellis says, pales in comparison to what the NFL hopes to build in media rights, sponsorship, and merchandise deals once European audiences are converted into fans who watch 50-plus games a year rather than one. Earlier expansion efforts struggled in part because the league assumed the product would sell itself, Ellis says. It understood almost nothing about how outsiders actually saw the game. To the uninitiated European viewer, American football can seem chaotic, he says. They view it as a spectacle more than a sport. Big men in gladiatorial armor colliding, stopping, colliding again, then cutting to commercials. By contrast, 41% of Americans say football is their favorite sport, a Gallup survey found. most Americans absorb the rules by cultural osmosis long before they could articulate them, says Ellis. Strip away that lifetime of exposure, and you're left with, quite frankly, a baffling and barbaric game. When Ellis joined the NFL in 2018, he commissioned research across the league's priority markets to get a better understanding of awareness and perception of the sport internationally. Many international viewers simply hadn't registered that these enormous men are also elite athletes, world-class sprinters, some of them Olympic medalists, Ellis said. They're ballet dancers, but they're 280 pounds of muscle. His team ran a parallel study. What does someone need to know to enjoy the game? The research found that the two factors most likely to put a newcomer off, the sport's complexity and its violence, are precisely what hooks them once they develop a deeper understanding of the sport. The NFL has also had to rethink how to market itself to a continent that doesn't do swagger, as Ellis puts it. U.S. sports marketing runs on swagger, he says. But the league's own research found that what reads as charisma in Dallas can land as arrogance in Dusseldorf, something that we would see as confident, they see as bro or too macho, he adds. As the NFL expands overseas, it's also having to contend with anti-American sentiment in some markets. Because American football is closely woven into U.S. culture, the sport is often associated with overt displays of patriotism, such as flag ceremonies and military flyovers. Abroad, Ellis said, the league has had to tread carefully, because that same patriotism can be read as political in nature by international audiences if it isn't handled correctly. The financial stakes explain why Europe matters so much to the league. NFL revenue topped $23 billion in the past fiscal year, according to S&P Global Market Intelligence, and the league is targeting $25 billion by 2027. Media rights are the largest contributor. The NFL's current broadcast deal, worth nearly $110 billion over 11 years, accounts for almost half of total annual earnings. Replicating this model in Europe would represent a major financial boon. The lesson from prior endeavors is that new markets aren't won by adopting a product to suit local tastes. They're won, as Ellis says, by exporting the real thing unchanged and building the story, stars, and trust. Not to change directions entirely, McDonald's has been a staple of U.S. culture for a long time. Here's an article on how they're doing in the marketplace. It's by Phil Waba from Fortune magazine, dated August 3rd. McDonald's CEO turns to a trusted lieutenant with a turnaround record to revive its biggest market. McDonald's has a new president, Sky Anderson, to lead its mammoth but sluggish U.S. business after its bet on cheaper items enticed fewer cash-strapped Americans than expected, even as consumers grapple with an affordability crisis. The company said on Tuesday that sales at established U.S. restaurants rose only 0.8% in the second quarter, the slowest pace since early 2025, and below Wall Street expectations. McDonald's has trotted out more offerings for its price-sensitive diners, such as a $4 breakfast, and more items for under $3, as high gas and grocery prices leave millions of Americans with less discretionary income. Yet its efforts to spotlight its comparatively inexpensive menu items fell short, with fewer people visiting McDonald's U.S. restaurants. McDonald's CEO Chris Kempczinski said company strategy was sound, but that the chain had made unforced errors. These included too many new product launches at once, overwhelming many U.S. restaurants, slowing service, and annoying customers. What's more, he said, the marketing for so many simultaneous initiatives made it hard to break through to customers with a clear message about value. We don't have a strategy problem. We simply didn't execute at the level we needed to in the second quarter, the CEO told analysts on a conference call. To help remedy that, McDonald's said it had appointed Anderson as the new head of its biggest market and touted the 26-year company veteran's operational prowess and business acumen. She's a proven change agent who can act with urgency to mobilize our system, Kempczinski said, praising her for being a hands-on leader who's demonstrated strong business judgment and operational discipline. The two executives know each other well. In fact, when Kempczinski led the U.S. business from 2017 to 2019, he asked Anderson to leave her job in Australia as regional CFO and come back to the U.S. to lead its West Coast business. The CEO touted Anderson's record in that role, saying that she had modernized more than 5,700 restaurants and that comparable sales growth had soared. The new gig shows how quickly Anderson's star is rising at McDonald's. Before becoming U.S. Chief Operating Officer only 4 months ago, she was head of McDonald's Global Business Services Unit, where she focused on faster and more modern operations at restaurants. McDonald's does not break out its markets by revenue, but analysts estimate that the U.S. makes up 40% of the chain's global business, equivalent to roughly $10 billion. Anderson will have her hands full as she takes on the new assignment. McDonald's is about to embark on a massive U.S. restaurant remodeling program, for which it needs franchisee buy-in, which could be tough given the soft results of late. Franchisees who operate the vast majority of U.S. restaurants can opt out of discounts, and indeed, just 60 to 65% of its restaurants had implemented its under $3 menu amid fears of lower margins. Earlier this year, McDonald's unveiled a new global business strategy called McDonald's Next, which will introduce upgraded menu items such as hand-breaded chicken, test new store prototypes, and launch new marketing, meaning ever more operational complexity. And the company will be doing that against a backdrop of persistent inflation. We see an opportunity to raise the bar in the United States and accelerate performance in our largest market, Kempczinski said. And that task will now fall to one of his most trusted lieutenants. Here's a quick article about Honda and its recent performance from the Associated Press and Fortune magazine dated August 3rd. Honda doubles its profits as motorcycles and a weak yen fueled its post-EV write-down comeback. Tokyo-based Honda Motor Company said Wednesday its April-June profit totaled $2.9 billion, up from half that for the same period a year ago. Quarterly sales rose 13.5% to $38 billion as vehicles sold well in the U.S. and India, according to the maker of the Accord sedan, the Fit subcompact, and the Super Cub motorcycle. Honda previously recorded a $2.7 billion loss for the fiscal year ended in March, acknowledging heavy costs for its electric vehicle plans, which didn't measure up to the original ambitions, partly because of U.S. President Donald Trump's policies. Analysts say many consumers weren't ready to go electric. Honda has abandoned many of its plans for EV models. The Trump administration has pulled back an incentive program for EVs and withheld money to states wanting to add more EV charging stations, even as gas prices have soared over the war in Iran. Trump's tariffs on imported autos and auto parts, lowered to 15% from the initial 25%, also worked to dent Honda's profitability. For the latest quarter, Honda's motorcycle operations were highly lucrative, with sales going strong in Brazil and India. Car sales grew in Japan and the U.S., while struggling in China. Kawaguchi said Honda's overall first quarter results were very healthy, thanks partly to a favorable exchange rate, although recent U.S.-Japan joint intervention has boosted the yen's value somewhat. The U.S. dollar traded higher during the first fiscal quarter compared with the previous year. A cheap yen is a boon for Japanese exporters like Honda because it raises the value of its overseas earning when translated into yen. Honda's expecting a return to profit for this fiscal year and raised its profit forecast to $2.5 billion from an earlier forecast of $1.6 billion. All the Japanese automakers have been impacted by last week's 7.1 magnitude earthquake in Kumamoto in southwestern Japan. Some production lines were temporarily halted and supply chains disrupted. Like other Japanese companies, Honda is going on a summer break later this month. Officials said they're hoping things will have returned to normal by the time they're back at work, and the exact impact of the quake on vehicle production is still unclear. Honda shares jumped 3.9% in Tokyo trading after the financial results were released. Are you a movie fan? If so, good news for you and IMAX. This from Forbes Daily Dozen. This summer brought about a resurgence for movie theaters, and IMAX is winning big. Shares of IMAX reached an all-time high on Monday as demand for The Odyssey made July its highest grossing month ever. IMAX's stock has surged 30% since the release of the film, which is the first major commercial release shot entirely on the cinema firm's large format cameras. And the movie theater party is still going with Spider-Man Brand New Day, which just had the biggest opening weekend in box office history. And now a couple of quick closing headlines and then we'll be done for the day. As the AI race between the U.S. and China heats up, Chinese tech giant Alibaba introduced its new AI model that it claims is comparable to or better than the latest offerings from Anthropic's Fable and OpenAI's ChatGPT. Billionaire Michael Saylor's strategy offloaded Bitcoin last week in a move that raised over $100 million as the cryptocurrency has faltered in the month since reaching an all-time high last October. Boeing shares surged 8% as the FAA certified its 737 MAX 7 model after a decade-long review and scrutiny of the company's aircraft following the 2024 Alaska Airlines door plug blowout. And with that, folks, we're done. Thank you so much for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11 a.m. Bye for now.